It's 22-1252 Watzig versus Halliburton Energy Services. And for the appellant Halliburton, it's Ms. Crowe. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, there was a delay in the transmission and the screen froze for a moment.
We can hear you now, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Heather Crowe, and I'm with the Coleman Firm, and I am here on behalf of appellant Halliburton Energy Services. And we respectfully ask this court to reverse the orders of the district court and to reinstate the arbitrator's summary judgment order in this matter. There are multiple issues in this case, any one of which is sufficient for the district court's orders to be overturned. But as an overarching matter, there are two glaring issues that we want to talk about today. One is the orders of the district court. Ms. Crowe, under the FAA, time out.
Contractual signal. Judge Matheson, Judge Ide, are you getting a convoluted signal?
It's every other word.
Yeah. Let's try it again. If that doesn't work, maybe we'll have you sign off and re-sign in.
Would you like me to do that now, Your Honor?
Why don't you proceed and let's see. But if you see me waving my hands like this, stop and we'll try to reboot you, okay?
Sounds good.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay. In addition to the fact that there's no subject matter jurisdiction, at its heart, this is a contractual dispute about procedure used in arbitration. The question, did the arbitrator correctly read the rules and apply them under the party's agreement, is not an appealable topic. That's sort of a quarrel, particularly when the party's agreement contains a delegation clause, doesn't fall within the very limited confines of the four exclusive basis for vacater under Section 10 of the FAA. Now, as to subject matter jurisdiction, once Mr. Watzig voluntarily dismissed his claim without prejudice under Rule 41, the district court no longer had jurisdiction. Federal subject matter jurisdiction, of course, can't be waived or stipulated or based on the party's conduct. And as this court held in the Andrew versus Waltz, Colorado case, it can't be conferred by a party's arbitration agreement. So even if the motion to reopen was procedurally correct or timely, it was neither. But even if it had been, there were no exceptional circumstances that would support a Rule 60 motion and offer any other pathway back to the original case.
Ms. Crowe, why wouldn't the voluntary dismissal without prejudice be a final proceeding for purposes of Rule 60 that would let the district court loop back to the original filed lawsuit and use that as the basis for the Rule 60 reopening?
Your Honor, two points there. First, as to the whether or not Rule 60 would apply, as it's not a final proceeding. When a party dismisses under Federal Rule 41A1AI, that operates under operation of law as a dismissal, and it strips the court of summary judgment, and it puts the parties back into the same position that they would have been had the case never been filed.
Why isn't that a proceeding, though? You have, Rule 60 talks about a final judgment, a final order, and then it brings in this notion of a proceeding, which I really didn't see a whole lot of authority that attempts to define it, but why wouldn't, one reasonable interpretation be that a proceeding includes a filed cause of action that's then dismissed, albeit voluntarily? Why wouldn't that fit in Rule 60?
That wouldn't fit into Rule 60 because Rule 60 is meant to set aside a particular judgment, a final ruling on something. There's no final ruling on a dismissal that has been made voluntarily and without prejudice. And that's contrasted with a dismissal voluntarily or not that's with prejudice. And that is a final proceeding.
Can you give me an example of what a final proceeding might be?
Sure. Let's say that, well, if the court ruled on something, that would be a final proceeding. The parties could resolve their issue. They could settle the agreement, or they could settle the dispute. And they could obviously file a voluntary motion to dismiss with prejudice. That would be a final proceeding.
Would that lead to the court entering some type of order or judgment? So we would need the term proceeding, would we?
Not necessarily, but it would depend on what they filed it under. It would depend on how they filed it under Rule 41. It would depend on if the court ordered a dismissal for some reason. Perhaps it's a Rule 12b6 motion, and the court looks at it and said, this is untimely on its face, and so we're going to dismiss this with prejudice. That would be a final proceeding.
Counsel, just to clarify one of your answers to Judge Timkovich, are you saying that if the voluntary dismissal had been with prejudice, that Mr. Weitzig could have used Rule 60B to vacate the dismissal?
I think that he could have. And here's the difference. There's two cases in the Tenth Circuit that talk about this.
One of them would be Schmier.
Correct. One of them would be Schmier and one of them would be Netwig. And Netwig is the case that is the closest on point here. In Netwig, the plaintiff dismissed the case without prejudice voluntarily before an answer or summary judgment had been filed. So it was the same scenario factually that we have here. The difference there is that there was a debate about who objected to the setting aside of that. But the courts are clear that when it comes to subject matter jurisdiction, the parties can't consent, and the actions of the parties don't establish subject matter jurisdiction.
Well,
so,
just a quick follow up then. Since Mr. Weitzig was barred from refiling under Badgero was decided in the midst of all this. Why didn't that render the dismissal without prejudice functionally the same as a dismissal with prejudice? In other words, giving it the finality needed so that he could pursue the motion under Rule 60B.
Well, the courts have held, and we cited some of these cases in our brief, that a change in the law doesn't constitute exceptional circumstances under Rule 60. So we would argue that doesn't provide a basis anyway. And furthermore, even if the court did reopen the case, there's still no basis for subject matter jurisdiction. The cases that have allowed subject matter jurisdiction to proceed are those that the Badgero court referred to in the dissent as a potential jurisdictional anchor. And so that's the cases where a case is ordered to arbitration by the district court under Section 4 of the FAA. 4 allows look-through jurisdiction, so there is a jurisdictional basis there. And then the court would stay the case. That's not what happened here. So even if the court reopened the case, there's still no jurisdictional anchor that would provide him jurisdiction for his motion under Section 10 of the FAA.
He originally had federal question jurisdiction, though, didn't he, when he filed the case?
That's correct.
And why would that go away?
Well, that would go away because, number one, there's no live case or controversy if he's dismissed it, or if it's already been adjudicated by the arbitrator. There's also no common nucleus of facts, so it wouldn't support supplemental jurisdiction. His original claim was an ADEA claim. The claim that's been brought in front of the court now is a procedural issue that springs out of the arbitration itself.
Okay, help me though, going back to your response to my question about whether he could have reopened if he had dismissed with prejudice. Let's say that was the scenario. What would be the jurisdictional anchor then? If you say he can do that, then you must think that there was some basis for jurisdiction in that circumstance.
No, well, Your Honor, I'm not conceding that there was jurisdiction, but I am acknowledging that he might be able to reopen the case, but even if he did reopen the case or set it aside, he still doesn't have that jurisdictional anchor. There's no bridge back from the arbitrator's, the issue with the arbitrator's assessment of the rules in the contractual dispute. There's no bridge back or jurisdictional anchor back to the original ADEA claim.
Well, what's the difference between a dismissal with prejudice and one without prejudice like we have here? Why would one support a Rule 60 reopening and the other not?
A dismissal with prejudice ends the matter. That's a final determination. And the only thing that he can do is potentially appeal if it's an appealable order. Here, obviously, it wasn't. The difference between that and a dismissal that was without prejudice is it puts the parties back in the position that they were originally in. He could have refiled. The problem for him here was that, number one, if he refiled, he was precluded by Badgero, or if he went to state court, he was precluded by the statute of limitations.
Do you agree that there are cases in other circuits ruling that a party can use Rule 60B to vacate its own voluntary dismissal without prejudice?
There's one case that sort of seems to be the case that everyone points to, and this is the argument they need to make, and that's the Yesh case out of the Fifth Circuit. That case is, if you go down the rabbit hole on what that case is based on, that case points to three circuit court cases. But if you read those cases, all of those cases were actually a dismissal with prejudice. The Yesh court also talks about several other cases that it uses as examples, but all of those are distinguishable in some specific way. We've outlined those in our brief. But for example, one of them talks about what if there is a Rule 11 issue? It's sort of a collateral type of jurisdiction that the court might still have. So if someone, for instance, was held in criminal contempt, or the court gave the example of a defendant faked his own death, for example, in order to secure a dismissal, those types of issues would, under the court's inherent authority, give the court jurisdiction to deal with those things. But that's not the same as what we're talking about here.
Counsel, could I get you to address the Christina case that under the 10th Circuit, our own precedent? You make an argument in your brief that maybe we should be looking at that case. Could I get you to make that argument or tell me how it applies here?
Well, it's another holding. It's one of multiple holdings where the court says that a voluntary dismissal without prejudice is not a final decision. It's not a ruling on the merits. It's not a determination by the parties or party that this has been dismissed with prejudice and it's not coming back.
Thank you.
You also make an argument that the filing of the FAA appeal was it was untimely because the 3 months had passed, but why shouldn't we read the rule, the JAMS rules, to start the clock ticking at that 14-day points? Both you and the plaintiff agreed to the abide by the rules, and JAMS provides a bright line for when the parties have to be cognizant of an appeal. What would be the basis for ignoring, the parties' agreement on when the clock starts ticking for purposes of the 3 months?
Your Honor, first of all, that rule is, as you mentioned, a JAMS rule. It is not a statute. It is a rule of an administrative body that is overseeing and carrying out the arbitration. The statute under the FAA is very clear. It says that you have 3 months following the issuance and the delivery of the order. That's it. It doesn't provide any exceptions. It doesn't provide for tolling. It doesn't provide anything else that might give you an extension there. JAMS doesn't have the authority to abrogate the FAA or create a rule that would change that.
Well, it's a pretty big trap for parties that go through JAMS arbitration then, it seems.
That's the language of the statute, Your Honor, and also the language in the rules. And I would also point out that that particular 14-day rule is also a double-edged sword for Mr. Watzig, because that particular rule says that if it's final, it's final. Well, all of the other rules that were disregarded by Mr. Watzig were the rules that said if you have a procedural objection or you would like for the if you would like for the order to be modified, there are procedures for that. You submit it in writing. And if you don't do that, the rules plainly state that you have waived any objections. And there is a 14-day outer limit on that. And he didn't object. So he waived all of his objections.
All right. Looks like your time's about up. Unless there's other questions, let's hear from Mr. Cohen.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Austin Cohen. On behalf of my firm, Cotney Cohen, we are here on behalf of the appellee, Gary Watzig. So to start, just to go to some of the questions that that you were asking, in the context of Rule 41, and then we were talking about whether the notice that we filed was a final proceeding or final order. We talked about cases, but we have to look at the timeline of the cases. So we talked about the Newtwig case first, right? But then after that came Schmier. And Schmier distinguished itself from Newtwig, basically, and says, kind of without distinguishing whether it's with prejudice or without prejudice, that this is that the plaintiff in that case, or the person that was asking for it, this is a final proceeding and you can use Rule 60. And then this court, it's an unpublished opinion, but in McKinsey, in the footnote, and it's cited in our brief, the court basically says that if it was dismissed under the rule that we used for Rule 41, you could nonetheless still file under Rule 60. And I think that in Halliburton's brief, that was addressed in a footnote, but the court, Judge Mix, as well as us, we relied on that. And that is the natural extension of the McDonald's case, right? Of Schmier v. McDonald's. That was the next step. And it makes sense, because without your ability to do that, there is no resource. And if you go to the whole purpose of Rule 60 in terms of the grand reservoir of power, that's one way that you can implicate that. So
where's the, first of all, what is a proceeding mean, and where would the finality be for a voluntary dismissal without prejudice? What's final about that?
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of what is occurring, right? And so if that ends the entire action and there's nothing else that can happen, that is final. Granted, you can refile, but
you could have refiled the next day after the dismissal.
That is true.
So why would there be finality there when clearly there isn't? I mean, obviously, at some point, an action becomes barred by a statute of limitations or repose, or, arguably in this case, a change of law might have barred a substantive victory. But, until some future event occurs, you really don't have finality, because you're always free to refile your complaint. And start the case anew, serve process and off we go.
Yeah, Your Honor, you are correct. And there's not much that I think under normal circumstances, that is the rule, and there are sound reasons behind that. But we're looking at an exception here. We're looking at unusual circumstances, and I think that's really what the court was getting at in Yesh. It's what the Tenth Circuit was sort of addressing in Schmier, and as well as in McKinsey, those sort of exceptional circumstances when.
Well, counsel, how important was the Supreme Court's decision in Badgerow to your argument that you're making right now, as far as finality goes?
What and you're talking about right now, not in arguments that we have.
No, the discussion we're having at this moment about finality, the questions that Judge Timkovich was asking you. I haven't heard you mention Badgerow, and my question is whether it is relevant and beyond that important to your argument.
Yes, Badgerow is relevant, and still to this day. I mean, Badgerow held that there has to be an independent basis for jurisdiction. That's what Badgerow held at the time that it was issued. Different people were interpreting it differently. We struggled with it, admittedly, at that time. But currently, what our argument is, as time has gone on and we have seen courts interpret Badgerow, it's that Badgerow requires an independent basis for jurisdiction, and the independent basis is the federal common law claims that we have cited. And so what Badgerow did was it certainly helped. What Badgerow did was it injected confusion into the situation. And so it's much more relevant sort of towards the 60B6 totality analysis in terms of how this was dealt with and how that also impacted whether we did any refiling at the time.
Well, this takes me to the point that Ms. Crow was making earlier about a jurisdictional anchor. I mean, once you come back to federal court and you've got your motion to reopen, and maybe the court says, we'll let you in the door, but what is the jurisdictional anchor for you to proceed at that point in challenging the arbitration proceedings?
That would be the federal common law claims of manifest disregard for the law, because that is federal law. And so through those claims, there is a federal question. And so if we are interpreting if we are purely saying that all the grounds under Section 9 of the FAA are purely matters of state law because they're contractual, then the federal common law claims, and we cited to this in our brief, are federal questions. And so if the court is deciding those federal common law grounds, it can also decide the FAA grounds, even if those are, you know, because those essentially are basically under Badgerow considered state law, questions of state law, because it has to deal with contracts. And we did cite to the common law claims in the trial court. And even in Judge Mix's opinion, she cites to manifest disregard for the law. I think one of the things that Halliburton discussed was that in our original filing, we didn't meet the requirements under FRCP 8. And, you know, I would disagree with that to the extent that there wasn't sufficient notice provided. I do agree there was not a lengthy analysis, but we did cite to the federal common law grounds. And the judge did cite to that in her opinion, Judge Mix. And so, you know, I do agree it was not expressed and clear on its face, but it was cited, and the rules are interpreted you know, liberally. And also, Rule 8 does not require, Rule 8 essentially requires them to have notice. And we do believe that there was notice there.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, can you just rephrase your argument then? I mean, I guess you admit that you did not raise the Badgero argument in its current form before the district court, but by citing federal common law, you preserved it. Is that what you're arguing?
Not exactly. Yes. So sorry, I just wanted to make sure I understood your question. I mean, yes, because the question is, were they on notice to know that these federal common law grounds were being pled at that time? And so maybe they were, we pled them and we mentioned them in a different context. And I admit that, because at the time that we filed the motion to reopen and vacate the judgment, Badgero hadn't been decided yet. So although we mentioned them, it hadn't been decided. And so we mentioned them, we mentioned it differently.
Okay. But your argument is that your discussion or mentioning them is sufficient to preserve your argument before us.
Yes. And I would also add to that, that even if the way we mentioned it was insufficient, there is both case law and statutes that would allow us to amend that or even raise those on appeal, starting with the statute. And this was not in our brief. It's just to full transparency here to answer your question. 28 USC 1653. And then that says defective allegations of jurisdiction may be amended upon terms in the trial or appellate courts. And then I have a 10th Circuit case that says 28 USC 1653 is an exception to the rule that basically allows you to consider jurisdictional arguments for the first time on appeal, because what we are looking for here is to establish jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you.
I think a related question, but it's really a clarification of what you argued, I guess, both in district court and here. Did you make an argument based on, I guess this is part of the FAA, 9 USC Section 10, about vacating an arbitration award, and the statute discusses the situation where the arbitrators exceeded their powers or so imperfectly executed them that a mutual final definitive award upon the subject matter submitted was not made. Did you rely on that statute? In other words, if there's a federal question, you've been talking about federal common law, but why wouldn't you be relying on that statute?
Because at the time that we filed this, we didn't think that we had to do that because Badgero had not come out. So prior to Badgero coming out, it was kind of like we felt as though the grounds under Section 9, most of them were just clearly met. And so, you know, again, so we thought they were met. So we thought, why do we need to do this long, detailed analysis of the federal common law grounds? We cited to them, but why would we need to do that? Because this was never a problem. I mean, we looked at this and said, she didn't, you know, this is a one person riff where they hired someone younger. And then we're coming in and saying, you have to give a reasoned award. No explanation whatsoever was given. And we said, this was part of the contract. This is so clear. Why do this whole long analysis? Because as I look at the federal common law grounds, you know, there's discussion about, you know, do they still exist? Can you still use them? But when I look at them, I don't believe that if those still did confer jurisdiction, which I believe they do, and this court still has never said anything that they do not exist. But that wouldn't upset the balance of power between essentially Badgero's holding that almost all of the Section 9 type of grounds for vacator should go to the state, because the federal common law grounds, although it's a little bit, it casts a broader net, it's still a higher standard, and it's still going to be more difficult to meet if you are alleging the federal common law grounds than if you're just alleging a couple or one of the grounds for vacator under the FAA. So it's not going to upset that balance between what I believe Badgero was trying to do, which was put a lot of these type of requests for vacator to the state courts. Now, whether that's a sound policy decision, I don't know. The state courts are so overburdened that having them review things like this, I think is problematic, but that's not what we're here to decide today. But I just to touch on that point, I don't think that it would upset that balance.
Could you respond briefly to Ms. Crow's point about the three month and the trigger date for the filing requirement?
Yeah, the agreement's clear as to when that had to happen, and the parties contracted to follow that. And so I think that, the agreement is clear that when an award is final for purposes of, and it even says, it even writes in there for purposes of appeal. Right. So, yeah.
Can you contract around the statutory command though?
There are different rules surrounding contracting around the statute, right? So you can't confer jurisdiction. And I know that was brought up earlier, and we all agree, you cannot confer jurisdiction. What you can do is you can contractually, and I don't like to use the word remove jurisdiction, but you can contractually agree that the court can't consider certain things. Mm-hmm. And that is actually, it's discussed in the context of removing the court's jurisdiction in both Halliburton's brief and our brief. But really what we're saying is that we're not saying that you can contract to confer it. We're just saying you can contract to remove it. In this case, the parties did contract that judicial review would be part of the agreement. It's multiple times throughout different rules. And so that was a material term.
Okay. All right. Do the panel have any additional questions for Mr. Cohen? Thank you. We went over a little bit. Ms. Crowe, you can take a minute in rebuttal if you have anything else to offer.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to make two very brief points, and I appreciate the extra time. Number one is as to the discussion with Rule 41 and finality, if there's not some sort of finality, then we're left with an endless mulligan. We're left with no finality and the ability to just continue to refile. The other point that I wanted to make is as to manifest disregard. The court was really clear in Hall Street and also in Badgero that the grounds for seeking vacatur under the FAA are exclusive, and there are only four. And so under the statute, and so if manifest disregard, it has to do one of two things. It's either another way to say one of the terms that's already under the FAA, one of those four reasons, or it's a standalone issue. And the court has said that there is no look-through jurisdiction. There's no jurisdiction without an independent basis for those four issues. So it's illogical that that a party can create or point to an outside common law basis for jurisdiction when the courts and the statute are very clear that this is exclusive. And if you don't fall within this, you don't get to come. And also, in addition, you have to have an independent basis for jurisdiction. You can't go around that by using a judicially created piece of common law that the viability of is seriously in question anyway.
All right, counsel, thank you. We appreciate you appearing by Zoom this morning. You are excused, and the case will be submitted.